I will be talking about real-time programming on Linux in userspace. I am Lennart Pötterling. I'm a software engineer with Red Hat. If you want to contact me, use that. I wrote Pulse Audio. I wrote Avahi. It's Pulse Audio where most of the stuff I will be talking about is being used. This talk is basically about my experiences with programming real-time software on Linux at the on the example of Pulse Audio. So, oh, by the way, if anyone has questions, just ask immediately. I think it makes much more sense if we stay on topic for all those questions. So, yeah. I got a lot of slides prepared. Most likely we are not going to be able to go through them all, but that's okay. The talk is going to be a large bag of different things that you should be knowing if you do real-time programming on Linux. It's a long list. It's ordered by the importance. If you want to know the whole thing, then go and go through the slides on your own. If we don't manage to do them all here. So, what is real-time programming? Whenever an RT process is able to run, it runs. That's different from the usual scheduling on Linux, where a process is always scheduled only for a certain time slice, and then the next process is scheduled, and then the next one, and then the next one. RT threads run as long as they want, or at least as long as not a higher priority real-time process wants to run. Where is this real-time stuff used? It's an ABS, medical systems, finance, audio, the list goes on and on and on. It's generally used everywhere where small latencies are required. That's, for example, at the ABS system for the car braking brakes. This is required so that if we actually need the ABS, then that the reaction of the system actually comes and is not delayed by some other process doing something. So a medical system, that's obvious. We really need to make sure that all the medical things happen and are not to delayed to any non-defined point in time. So our focus here is going to be audio. I'm doing this talk because of Pulse Audio, so that's my focus here. That's a very specific kind of real-time. It's a very soft real-time stuff. I'm also focusing on the desktop use for real-time. So this is not the professional audio stuff. This is unprofessional audio. This is the desktop stuff. This kind of weakens the requirements we have on real-time. We can do things other people cannot do with real-time. I'm doing this talk primarily because I want to get people to know the real-time stuff too, that they can actually use it in their own programs. Because right now, if you, for example, play a video, that would be an ideal application where real-time scheduling should be used. Because if you play a video, it should be made sure that every frame is shown at the right time. And that does not happen that if some other process does something, the video is delayed, and so the video starts to jump. Video is one occasion. Audio is obviously the most interesting one, because in contrast to video, we need to wake up very, very fast, do our job, go to sleep again. So another area where this real-time stuff could be used on the desktop is, for example, making sure that the mouse cursors are shown very quickly. Like that can't happen that because we are not scheduled often enough, the mouse cursor starts to get bumpy. We want quick reaction. So again, our focus is desktop audio on Linux. As I already mentioned, this is a very soft real-time. Traditionally, on real-time, there is this differentiation between hard and soft real-time. That basically means in hard real-time, the schedulings are really guaranteed. And if a process doesn't use all the time it asks for first, then it's not used at all. So generally, Linux does only soft real-time. And because we do it on the desktop, we do it a very soft way. Because the Pulse Audio Sound Server, for example, it should never drop out. That's why we do the real-time stuff. But on the other hand, it's just audio. It doesn't really matter if there's pressure on cache or if there's real pressure on memory. If we get dropout then it's OK. But in the general case, we don't want very hard real-time. So Linux has these real-time features that has been available since a long time. Linux is quite good as a real-time kernel these days. It's much better than Windows is or macOS is. There is a specific real-time kernel which has lots of patches, which actually makes the real-time kernel even better than it is. I'm mostly focusing on the normal kernels, like they're shipped in all the distributions, which are, I mean, you need a new kernel, and then you can get, it can do all kinds of real-time stuff that is not as good as the patch kernel, but it's good enough. Again, this is soft real-time. So usually, if a process, a non-real-time process, is scheduled, we have a scheduling latency. That means if anything is supposed to happen, or anything happened, how much time does it take until the program can actually process that? With the normal scheduling, this usually is dependent on a couple of parameters. This includes the aset value of the Linux kernel. The aset value basically says how often per second should the kernel switch tasks. On Linux, it used to be something like 100, I think. Then they raised it to 250. You can compile it with 1,000. That means 1,000 times a second, the threads are switched one to the next to the next. That basically means that it can take about 10 milliseconds. 1 second, 1,000 times per second means 10 milliseconds scheduling timeout can happen. It's also dependent on the CPU load, of course. If you have two threads that want full CPU time, then it's twice the HZ time that it takes to get scheduled. So, making process real-time. Basically, if you want to enter real-time mode for a process or a thread, you just call one function, which is called pthread setScheduler. I can show that here. That's the name. I hope you guys can read that. Basically, you just call that function, and the calling thread was going to be real-time. Real-time, there are different modes of real-time. There's one called FIFO, and one is called RR. It doesn't really matter which one you choose. It only matters for very few applications, the difference. I'm not going to go into very much detail here, like you have to code with it. The man pages go into the detail. If you want to know that, read the man pages. I just want to tell you where to look. So, real-time processes have priorities. On Linux, they are something like range from 1 to 99. This is used because there are, you can use, for example, if you have something that is very important, you can run it at very high real-time priority, and something less important, you can run it at lower priority. That basically means as soon as a process with a high real-time priority can run, it will run, and potentially a one with a lower real-time priority will be paused for that. So generally, if you do real-time programming, you have to do a few things to make sure that everything actually works the way you want. Just enabling real-time scheduling for a thread is not sufficient. You also have to adjust to the way real-time works. That means I'm assuming that everyone who's here in this room has some experience with thread programming, with concurrent programming, and that everyone should know that the usual thing you do, at least when what you learn in university, that you use locks, mutexes, to protect concurrent data access, to make sure that every time one thread needs to access a shared memory area or shared data structure, it first takes a lock, then does its notification, then gives the lock up. It's just to make sure that there are no incomplete operations on the data. The thing with real-time is locks are problematic because locks serialize stuff. If you have a shared resource, two threads want to access it, and both have to take the lock, that basically means that the access to the data structure is serialized. First one has to finish, and then the other has to finish. That may or may not be a problem. If the access to the data is actually very fast, it might not be a problem to do the lock. But if it takes some time, this becomes really a problem because you don't get the latencies anymore because you always have to wait for the other threads. What the fuck? What happened now? Oh, great. X crash. What's that? I guess that's what you get when if you run Rawhide. That's not good. Oh my. Dude. Yeah. I'm sorry, the machine is totally crushed. I have to reboot that. I wonder what that is. Okay, I will continue without my slides now until this thing is fully booted up.
You described audio as from the world of software time. Signal processing from
I mean, desktop audio is not about hard real time. If you have such a processing loop, then it's probably more embedded real time. I'm sorry, I was a little bit distracted here right now. Oh my, what a mess.
Okay, if we've got more folks asking questions, can we pass this round?
Okay, then could you just repeat? Can you repeat the question?
Repeat the question.
Yeah.
To make a distinction between soft and real hard time audio applications, I just ask, are there some applications which are actually considered hard real time? And so you're nodding your head, so I see the answer is yes.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It depends on what you're doing. My focus is mostly not that hard real time-ish, but there's, of course, a lot of stuff where it does make sense and does make on Linux, but I'm focusing here on the very soft real-time stuff. So, where were we? Logs. So, basically, you need to avoid the logs. It's not the problem, only that if you use logs, everything is serialized. There's also something called priority inversion that can happen. What there?
I've got a question about locks. I understand it's good to avoid locks in general with any multi-threaded task, and it's good to keep your critical sections small. Why is it more important in real-time programming?
Because in real-time programming, you want to guarantee usually that you have small latencies and guaranteed latencies. Like you will always want to make sure that on every single operation or external event that happens, you can react in a certain time frame, like 5 milliseconds. Like some signal comes in from the sound card, you want to make sure that you can process it in 5 milliseconds. So, however, if you have something you lock and two threads lock it and everything's serialized and you have the real-time thread and the non-real-time thread, then might happen that the real-time thread has to wait for the non-real-time thread for an arbitrary time. Like, it takes the lock for 100 milliseconds, and if the real-time thread then wants to do this as well, it just can't. It needs to wait until the other one finishes. Okay. That specific problem is related to priority inheritance, because with priority inheritance, the problem is you have two threads. They're running with different priorities. Let's say one is real-time, one is not. They want to access a shared data structure. Then first, the first one, the low priority one, gets the lock, has the lock, and doesn't give it up for quite a while. Then the high priority process comes, wants to take the same lock. Now what happens is because the first thread was not real time, and the real time has to wait for the non-real time thread, then something happens because he needs to wait for something that is not scheduled as real time thread. So the priorities are inverse in this area. On Linux, you can actually work around that. There's something called, yeah, let me open the slides again. Ooh, it even went directly back to the last one we had. So, avoid logs. The problem is, as I said, priority inversion. On Linux, you can do this piecewise priority inheritance. That means that every time a log is taken, we note the priority of the thread that took it. No, it's the other way around, actually. If a thread wants to take a log, the current owner of the log gets an increased priority. So if you use this, this problem goes away. It comes at a price still. It's still a lock. It's still serializing. But it's a not so well-known feature. Linux provides it. OK. I said avoid locks. The problem, of course, with avoiding locks is that we need to find some way, if we have shared data structures, to access them without stepping on each other's toes all the time. That's called lock-free programming. Lock-free programming is a science of its own, basically. Lock-free programming is a hard thing to do. There's a lot of scientific research going on in this area. There are actually two things. Lock-free programming, wait-free programming. Lock-free programming does without all the locks. Wait-free programming is something even better than lock-free programming. Because if you do lock-free programming, you usually have a few things called atomic operations. Atomic operations will execute atomically, like either they are executed or they're not yet executed. There's no time in between where, for example, a other thread or another CPU could interrupt them. Usually, if you do lock-free programming, you do all your changes, and then you check if all your changes went through without any interruption by some other thread. If those changes didn't go through, then we retry. If we do that, then we do not have wait-free programming anymore, because it might happen that we spin. We try it, we see it didn't work. We try it again, and so on and so on. So lock-free programming is a big thing. Wait-free programming is a smaller subset of those algorithms, which is even harder. Lock-free algorithms are difficult, wait-free even more so. So not for every program, not for a problem, not for every data structure, there are lock-free algorithms known. It's very, very hard to actually come up with new algorithms. So the best thing, if you ever need to do lock-free programming for real-time stuff, is not to think about it on your own, but trying and reading a book about it. Lock-free reference counting is one of the algorithms that's actually pretty easy if you do lock-free. It basically means everybody knows reference counting probably. If you do it lock-free, you have an atomic increment and atomic decrement operation. If the atomic increment is executed, you can then you get the return value of this operation, and that tells you what the new value is. So the good thing about this is that this way you can handle the lifetime of objects totally lock-free. Like most real-time system uses for memory allocation. There's another data structure called multi-reader, multi-writer lock-free queues. It's actually one of the very few, very simple data structures that are lock-free. There are a lot of algorithms that are very, very hard to develop in a lock-free fashion. Ironically, one of the simplest data structures in the non-lock-free world, which is the linked list, is very hard to do right in a lock-free way. Practically, it's not even possible on C right now with current processors. As I said, the building blocks for lock-free processes are those atomic operations. Atomic operations, there are a lot of different atomic operations available on the different CPUs. x86 has a lot of them. Some processors don't have any of them. One of them being ARM, for example, ARMv4. If you want to use atomic operations from your application, you need some kind of API that just wraps those processor operations for you in a nice way, and hopefully also abstracts them away a little bit. If you do that on Linux, it's a pain. There are several implementations of this stuff. Libatomic Ops is a special library which does all this kind of stuff. It's a little bit out of date, and there are issues, for example, on AMD 64. It offers a wide range of atomic operations. This is atomic increment, atomic decrement. It's usually something called CAS, which is the compare and swap, or and a few other things. Libatomic Ops has a nice thing that it emulates atomic operations, or at least tries to emulate atomic operations on architectures that don't have them natively. That comes with issues, however. And we'll go into detail with that a little bit later. So you can use the atomic implementations, atomic operations implementation from Libatomic Ops. You can use the one from glibc. It comes with one which is, however, a little bit problematic, because if you look into the source code, you will see that some of the operations on some architectures are almost atomic and not really atomic. It's a little bit sad to see. Also, these functions or these utilities are not exported in the glibc API. So basically, if you want to make use of them, you have to copy them out into your own source code. The glib library also has an implementation for atomic ops. It has a very different set from, or has a very small subset. Actually, I personally dislike the implementation from glib because, for example, it emulates the atomic operations on ARMv4. As I mentioned, that ARMv4 doesn't really have atomic operations. It does that in a very, very bad way. I actually blogged about that. If you want to know the details, then go to my blog and read about that. Basically, what it does is it spins this scheduled inside. And while that might be useful in non-real-time programs, it actually is a very stupid thing to do in real-time program, because a scheduled in a real-time program practically does nothing, because real-time says whenever your program can run, it will run. And so the schedule doesn't make any sense. The best way to do atomic operations on Linux is something called __sync. This is actually a feature of GCC. It's a very recent feature. It came into GCC from the IA64. It has now been ported to most other architectures, ironically not yet to x86 in any released version of GCC. However, a few distributions actually ship in a CVS version of GCC, where this is also viable for x86. The nice thing about this way to do atomic operations is that it's actually known by the compiler that these are atomic operations, and they are also type safe in contrast to most other implementations. I can only recommend, if you do atomic operation, use the GCC ones. It makes your program unportable, but on the other hand, it's the best implementation. And maybe you can abstract that away and use the atomic ops for everything else if you care about non-GCC compilers.
Sorry, I was going to say, it sounds like there's no good options that's good everywhere. So if you had x86, which one would you recommend? If you had ARM, you'd use sync, I guess.
And Pulse Audio, I use Libatomic Ops if I don't have the GCC stuff, and if I have the GCC stuff, I use that. Libatomic Ops works good enough. Unfortunately, it doesn't really. The emulation of the CAS operation is totally broken in Libatomic Ops 2 for real time stuff if you use it on ARM. So, kind of Pulse Audio running on ARM doesn't make so much sense right now.
So there's no solution for ARM.
Yeah, you can always code your own stuff. I know pretty well how it should be done. Read that blog story of mine. There you'll find the best solution that there is. There are 10 possible solutions how you can emulate that, and all of them are fucked. And one is...
Tell us what you really think.
Yeah, and there's one that actually works in real-time stuff. All the others have real issues in real-time stuff because they have a huge latency or... So basically, it's very difficult to do that. What I did with Pulse Audio is use Libatomic Ops on CPUs where I don't know it. Use sync when it's available, and for a couple of CPUs, I implemented natively, which, however, is much fun. Okay. Emulating Atomic Ops in kernel space is, by the way, very easy, because in kernel space, you can just disable interrupts. And if you disable interrupts, you're never interrupted. And so every operation you do, every number of operations you do in line is never interrupted. So you can do whatever you want and then re-enable them, and everything's fine. However, that On two CPUs, that becomes a problem, of course. However, the processors which lack atomic operations tend to not have multiple CPUs. They are not SMT capable, so that's not really a problem. Again, in kernel space, that's very easy because you can disable interrupts. In user space, that's not really the case. You kind of just go and disable interrupts. Actually, the Linux kernel provides a special page on some architectures, like ARM. If you jump to that page in memory, which has some weird address, fixed address, then it will trap into kernel mode, disable interrupts, do the cast operation, and go back to user space, re-enabling interrupts again. So this is a very, it's not a well-known feature, actually. If you look up that specific address, which is something like 1234567 8, if you look for it on Google, you'll find exactly two programs using it, one being NPTEL, and one being some strange stuff from some embedded vendor. I don't know. It's a very little known feature, and Libatomic Ops doesn't use it. The glibc version doesn't use it. NPTEL does use it. Glib doesn't use it. GCC doesn't use it either, as far as I know. So, yeah. Any questions for, regarding atomic operation or anything? Okay, the next thing is memory barriers. If you deal with atomic operations and multiple processors, you have the problem that many of the modern architectures reorder commands before they are executed. So if you have two processors, they both run some source code, and you wrote in your source code, do this, do that, and then do some other thing. Because of the reordering, this might appear in memory in a different order. So if you have those two processors running your code, it might happen that what you expect as an order is not the order, and things become messy. So to avoid this, there is something called a memory barrier. Memory barrier are processor features where you can say, okay, I want to make sure that the data I write to memory or read from memory is done in a very specific order. Memory barriers are a complicated issue. Libatomic Ops supports them very well. Like every single memory barrier, every totally random CPU can do, it's available in Libatomic Ops. On x86, there is only a single type of memory barrier. So on x86, it's actually very easy to do. The thing, however, is there are only about 10 people in the world, I guess, who actually do understand memory barriers in full. Not even the kernel people usually understand them full. Thus, my recommendation is forget about all those memory barriers. Always, when you do an atomic operation, do the full memory barrier stuff. If you do the full memory barrier, that comes at a cost, like because it locks down every single CPU and flushes all caches. What's your best option? On x86, really optimizing for the different types of memory barriers, like only for data, only whatever, doesn't really make any sense anyway, because x86 only has a single type of memory barrier. So my recommendation is always use a memory barrier. If you go into the APIs like glib, they generally don't offer anything but the single full memory barrier. So one important thing in every program is memory allocation. If you do malloc, basically, then this thing goes to the system, tries to get some memory, and hands it back to the application. And the thing is, usually in glibc, memory is allocated from pools, and those pools are I don't think they call it pool, they call it some other thing. And those pools are shared between threads. So now you have the problem if you call malloc, and memory is allocated from one of those pools, and another thread calls malloc as well, then you again have the issue with locking. So what a real-time programmer really wants is something which is lock-free memory allocation. That's actually a pretty hard thing to do. There are a couple of implementations around, but still not really much fun. If you go look at glib, then it says, hey, we have lock-free memory allocation. And they actually do have it, but they do it on a very dirty way, I think, and one that is not really useful for many real-time applications. Because what they basically do is every single thread has a special cache, a thread local pool where it allocates from. That way, each thread can allocate and free stuff on its own and never never has to serialize with other processes. However, if you, for example, write a program like Pulse Audio, where you have one thread that generates the data and one thread that frees the data again, like the consumer and the producer, producer and consumer, then it doesn't help you any. Because if you allocate memory, it's going to be allocated from the local thread, local pool. If you free it, you have to cross the thread boundary again to put it back into that pool. So while generally this is lock-free, it is not for the case where producer and consumer of those memory blocks are different threads. And that's the case for Pulse Audio. So instead of just believing that G-slice is lock-free, in many situations it's not lock-free. What I did in Pulse Audio is something called free lists, or call it location caches. As I mentioned earlier, there's multi-reader, multi-writer queues are actually one of the few data structures that are easy to implement lock-free. The solution is just to use one of them for every single type of data you have. And then if you want to allocate some memory, you pull it out of the queue. If you want to free them some memory again, you push it into the queue. And that way you can do without allocations. It comes with limits, of course. The queue has a fixed size, and you need to preload a lot of elements to make sure that even when the system starts up, you can always allocate without having to go to the system malloc. It's a little bit, we can do that because on Pulse Audio, because we don't do the real real-time stuff. If you really care about hard real-time, you probably shouldn't be doing it that way and use some real allocator for it. If you want to do real-time stuff, low-latency stuff, then you generally should avoid copying memory too much around, because if you copy memory around, then you put pressure on the caches. So you should try your best to do something like reference counter memory handling. So instead of many real-time programs take some data out of the sound card, for example, or some other data acquisition thing, do some processing on it, copying it into another buffer, do some more processing and copying into another buffer. It's usually better than always copying, just passing pointers around and using reference counting to make sure that the lifetime makes sense. Pulse Audio does it that way, for example. If we get some data from the sound card, we allocate a buffer and only pass the pointers to the buffer, which is reference counted around. And then when every single module that is in the pipeline or wants to access it frees it again, only then the data is freed. Then you generally want to do zero copy. That comes with reference count memory handling in a way. In Pulse Audio, we implemented that, for example, by if a client program wants to send some data to Pulse Audio, then the client application puts it directly into a shared memory block, a shared memory segment. And then the Pulse Audio server comes and says, okay, there's the data, and never copies any data around, and say it just hands it off to the right system call, for example. So to reduce the cache pressure and also to save memory, you should be using zero copy memory as much as possible. In many applications, you don't need to do that. If you just have a single buffer, then you obviously don't need to optimize a copy from it. But in stuff, for example, like Pulse Audio, zero copy and reference count memory handling is very important. Then there's this other thing. Any questions so far? Another thing is called memory locking. Memory locking is a very controversial issue, I would say. Generally, you have the problem on Linux, memory is paged, can be paged out to disk. If memory is paged out to disk and you access it again, then it needs to be paged back in. If you do that, then you lose a lot of time because disks are a million times slower than memory usually is. So in real-time programs and programs where we need always guarantee low latencies, that means if a page is paged out, that we need to page it in, that might take 50 milliseconds or so, and that might be much larger time than what we actually want to guarantee. So to fix that problem, the usual recommendation is to lock the whole process into memory. There's a system call for that called mlock and another one called mlock all. If you call the system calls, you can with mlock you can specify a range of memory, and then it's pinned into memory and will never be written out to disk. That generally works in embedded real-time, because in embedded real-time you can run everything as root. That system call is privileged, by the way. It must be privileged, because otherwise you could lock everything into memory and the system starts to crawl, because the remaining space is used for all the other programs and they're constantly swapping because they only have so little memory around. So on embedded real-time, that's not really a problem. You can do memory locking. Or the best way is probably in embedded real-time to just disable the swap entirely. But on the desktop, that's not really an option. I mean, Pulse Audio, for example, uses a lot of memory. For example, we have a sample cache where data can be loaded into. And if the data is in the sample cache, I mean, that it's audio data. It's a lot of memory. It can be several megabytes. And if you have 60 megabytes or so in Pulse Audio and it's always locked into memory, then that means that basically it's not used. It cannot be used by other applications. So the question is, should we really call this mlock all or not? If we do that, your systems might start to crawl. In Pulse Audio, I'm doing without mlock all and mlock. I instead use some system called mAdvise. If you use mAdvise, then you can specify that something should be paged in on demand. Like you just go there and say, okay, I'm now running in the non-real-time thread. I want to pass some data to the real-time thread. I want to make sure that the real-time thread does not need to go to disk to page the data in. So I first call this mAdvise on the data block I'm passing to the real-time kernel. This mAdvise call will just go to the kernel and tell them, yeah, I map that in. And then I pass it off to the real-time thread. And that's a very, very soft way to do it. And I don't need to do global memory locking. However, mAdvise has a problem. Until recently, it didn't really work for anonymous memory. It only worked for file-backed memory. So practically, this means, unless you're running the newest version of Linux, something fresh out of Git, you cannot use mAdvise. In Pulse Audio, we thus emulate this mAdvise thing by temporarily locking a page into memory. Because the mlock call guarantees you, after it returns, the specific pages you ask for will be in memory. So what Pulse Audio does is just mlock the memory, unlock it immediately again. That way, we can be sure that the data is in memory, and we don't constantly have a high memory pressure. Okay, so much about memory locking. If you go in on all those how-tos, how to do real-time programming, you always see the recommendation, you have to do mlock all. I think it's not a good idea. So if you, for example, use real-time in normal desktop applications, think twice before you just go for it and call that function. Any further questions so far?
You mentioned the mAdvise basically wasn't a solution until really recent kernels. Is it in 2.6.24 or is it still Q?
It's still in Git, I think, but I don't know. It has recent. I think it was posted on the mailing list by Peter Zylstra about a month ago or something. Okay, the next topic is going to be timers and sleeping. If you do real-time programming, then you're not going to eat up 100% CPU, because if you do that, then you're blocking the machine. Usually you have always user interface code that still needs to run. So many real-time applications just need to sleep for short whiles so that other stuff can run. Very often that's very simple to do. You just wait for some IRQ, sleep on a file descriptor or something like that. However, in many applications that's not sufficient. We need to sleep for time. Now the thing is, on Linux, sleeping for time is not that easy, or it at least didn't. It wasn't until recently. It wasn't easy to sleep for time properly, because system calls like nanosleep or sleep or select always rounded up the times you wanted to sleep for to one divided by h set. That basically means if you have a 100 h set kernel, then you cannot sleep for less than 10 milliseconds. Of course, that's not really suitable for real time stuff, because for audio you want 4 milliseconds or so. So in one of the recent kernels, like 2.6.20 or something, high resolution timers were added to the Linux kernels. A couple of system calls, like NanoSleep, I think I have a list here. Like NanoSleep, like the interval timers, like the POSIX timers, actually are ported to the high resolution stuff now. If you have a new machine which is x86, not even x86-64, then you can make use of this. That means you can pass a very, very short time span, like 50 nanoseconds or something, and the kernel will actually do something sensible with it. However, not all the... in the latest kernel, I saw that, yeah. But the thing is, of course, if you make use of this stuff, you need really to run the newest kernel. If you don't do that, then everything you sleep for a very, very long time.
I'm using 2621 on an ARM. I'm using 2621 on an ARM, and I'm still getting 20 milliseconds resolution on those timers.
Yeah, that's bad.
It is bad.
So, anyway, even AMD 64, you don't have that in the recent kernels, and that sucks. So, also, if it is available, and if you are one of the lucky people who have high resolution timers, then there's still the problem that it's only the three APIs that have been ported to high resolution timers. One of the most important APIs, which is poll or select, doesn't do real-time high resolution timers. That means in Pulse Audio, for example, we want to sleep for application input, we want to sleep for sound card interrupts, and we want to sleep for time. And if we just cannot use poll for this, because if we want to sleep for time, it's always still rounded up to 1 divided by HZ. That's a problem. However, we can actually work around that with some real messy code, because interval timers basically deliver timers via POSIX signals. So what we can do is we can use a relatively new p-poll system call, which works mostly like poll, but you can also listen for very specific signals. We combine these two to cancel this poll system time via a high resolution signal thing. That is a real pain in the ass. The reason is for each thread you want to do this with, you need to have a specific signal that can be delivered to it. So that means for each process, for each thread you have, you need to allocate one of the 30 or something real-time signals we have on Linux. 30 is not that much. Also, it's a shared resource. Like, if some code in your application wants to use it, they just take one. There is no scheme for allocating a real-time signal. So, this is a way you can work around the kernel limitations. It's a pain in the ass. It works, but yeah. Signals are evil for stuff like this. And then, of course, you have the problem with Pulse Audio. I want to have allow it to scale not only to a lot of hardware. I also want to have it scale to old kernels. And then the problem is the older kernels, of course, don't have any high resolution timer. So you have a problem there anyway. But it gets worse that I think the p-poll system call before 2.6.13 or something wasn't actually viable, and what the glibc did is emulating it, but this emulation just doesn't work because it can lose signals if you do that. So it's kind of limiting. Basically, if you want to do high resolution timers and wait for I/O at the same time, you really need some very, very, very new kernel. Any further questions on this?
Can you have a control file descriptor that the iTimer writes a character to, which wakes up the poll, or is that too slow?
You can do that, of course. I mean, Linux recently gained this timerft system call where you can make a timer a file descriptor. You can do that. I don't like that, however, because internally, if you reset the timer and arm it and disarm it, this always takes a lock. So, I mean, we're supposed to do without locking. It's not a problem if we take locks and we are the only ones who take the lock. But for example, if you use EventFD for communication, then the idea of EventFD, for example, is that one thread sends a signal, the other one gets it. So you always get this contention thing. I think it's the wrong direction of the Linux kernel to make everything a file descriptor because it makes everything lock full. I think that the better way would be something called K-Event, which some Russian guy was hacking on and submitting for the kernel, but he didn't continue with that. That solution is basically a replacement for poll and select, where the kernel just puts all those events in a specific memory area, and user space can just pull it out. And the good thing about it is that the communication between kernel and user space is lock-free. So that would be the ideal solution for all real-time stuff, because you only have to go into kernel mode, switch into kernel mode, in the contented case. Unfortunately, that project is not being pursued anymore. I'm very sorry about that. And I mean, currently in Linux kernel, everything goes into make everything a file descriptor. I don't think it's a good idea. But yeah, I'm not that much of a kernel guy, so.
Alternatively, would it be maybe a good solution to have a high-resolution timeout on the select, maybe a flag that would tell the kernel subsystem to use high-resolution timers for the select or for the people?
Yeah, of course. The best thing would be if people and select would just support high-resolution timeout. That would be... I mean, it's not as good as K-Event because it still requires some locking for the file descriptors you're sleeping on. But it would be a very easy way to fix it. I mean, and the APIs wouldn't need to be changed in anything. So, yeah, I'm waiting for that.
What?
It might be practical to really put a flag on this little app, though, because with the high-resolution timer stuff, and the distinguishing characteristics between those and the classic kernel timers are that the classic kernel timers are always are high-resolution timers are expected return, whereas classic kernel timers are expected to answer. So with the timeout on the select, depending on your usage, if you're trying to use the select as a periodic poll, then a high-resolution timer should be selected. If you're just expecting it as an emergency timeout for 30 seconds, and most of the time the select would get to the timer, then you should be classic. So I would think that probably you would have to have some sort of flag.
Yeah, Thomas Gleixner suggested something like just basing it on the actual amount of time you want to sleep for. If you want to sleep for only a few nanoseconds or something, then we use high resolution timers, and if you wait for a little longer than that, then we switch to the usual stuff. I don't know. There is apparently some work to add this stuff to the kernel, but it hasn't happened yet.
So one follow-up on that. One common case is if you are using poll without any FD list at all, essentially using it as kind of a more portable nanosleep. Is that something you do, or do you always have file descriptors you're polling for?
In Palsadia, I always have file descriptors to poll for, like the sound card, ALSA sound cards, that file descriptor I'm sleeping on, just to get events like the timing information is most accurate on sound cards shortly after the interrupt happens. So we really want to know when the interrupt happens, so we have that in the poll. Also, we want to be notified if someone pulls out the audio hardware, and then we want to be notified that, hey, that device went away, so, yeah. I mean, there are other solutions to work around the limitations of select. Select has other limitations. You cannot wait on a few text, on a mutex, and the file descriptor at the same time. That's also something that K-Event fixes. Some people then hack something up like turning a mutex into a file descriptor via a third thread or something, but that's really not something you want to do in real-time programming. I mean, real-time programming is just about low latency, so you don't want the extra latency comes through all this context switching. So, yeah, I think the solution, again, with canceling the system call is kind of working for me, but it sucks. Yeah, the next topic is anyone has any questions? Okay, the next topic is mutexes, semaphores, and conditions. Those are POSIX mutexes, semaphores, and conditions. On Linux, they are all implemented through something called futex, which is a fast user space mutex. It's a very generic way to implement all kinds of locks. Few taxes shouldn't be used directly. They always should be used through the POSIX API for it. Few taxes are a very sexy thing because if in the non-contented case, they are absolutely lock-free. We don't go into the kernel, and they are very, very fast. It's something that Linux does very, very well. Semaphores use those few taxes and are a good thing. If you need to take a lock, I mean, again, try to avoid it. If you need to take a lock, then semaphore is a good choice. However, in semaphore, you don't have priority inheritance or anything, so it's still a good choice because it doesn't go to kernel necessarily. Conditions, POSIX conditions, aren't a bad thing, however, because POSIX conditions always come with a mutex attached. So you always have to do the extra locking. So if you do wait on a condition, then you also have to lock first. Mutexes with priority inheritance are the best thing too, to sleep in real-time program. Yeah, again, Paul doesn't do few taxes. You can't combine waiting for file descriptors, timers, together with waiting for a mutex. That's actually very, very, it's a pity that we cannot do that. It would be very, very useful if we could do that, because in Pulse Audio, for example, the real-time thread, again, waits for audio I.O., it waits for applications, and it waits for time. And it would be great if we could actually use few taxes for this waiting for application input, but we can't. As I mentioned, there are several ways around it. The best way I have found is using the new event-free system call. I said everything is now being turned in kernel space in the file descriptor, so you can sleep on it. Again, I don't think it's a good idea because it you always need to go through to kernel space. It's not lock free. However, you can work around that by wrapping them in atomic operations. The basic idea is instead of just using EventFT like they're supposed to be used, we first increase some atomic number, then we check if basically what we do if the we duplicate, we shadow the status of the EventFT itself, of this semaphore that the EventFT is, in a memory area that we control now ourselves. So basically, if we want to increase the semaphore that is EventFT, we also do that in our own memory, which we can access lock-free, which we can just access with the normal atomic operations. And only if we notice, whoops, we have to wait, we actually call this system call for this. So basically how this then looks is you have your loop where the pole is in the middle, and before we enter the pole, we just check, is any of our EventFTs actually already filled up? And if so, we just know, okay, then we don't do the poll actually and just say, okay, the poll would return immediately, then we can skip it and we can do without the system call. It's a way that works. Pulse Audio does it that way. EventFT is a very new system call, so you don't have it on anything but Linux and you don't have it on older Linux kernels. You can emulate that with traditional FIFOs, but that's especially ugly. Yeah, again, the better solution for all this mess is K-Event, this thing the Russian guy is working on, but it's only theoretically, because it's not going to go in the kernel anytime soon. So with K-Event, you can sleep on timers, few taxes, FDs, and it's totally lock-free. So from a real-time perspective, that's the optimal solution and totally sexy. I think the guy just couldn't work with the kernel people. I don't know. So I still got a lot of slides, but the time is over as far as I understood, so some final questions.
Are there any of these techniques that are most portable to the other operating systems that some of us are forced to use?
Pulse Audio runs on Windows and on macOS and whatever. So we try our best to keep the compatibility. That actually works. Of course, you don't get as good as results. But I mean, you can deal with that. If you don't have the neatest and best API for everything, then you get large latencies for everything. But if you know that in advance, you can just say, okay, on Linux I can do 1 millisecond of latency, on Windows I can just do 100 milliseconds of latency. So, yeah, one can work still. I mean, it's one of the tough things to do. I mean, if you need to do all this signal allocation mess and doing that portably, it's very difficult. Yeah. No questions? Yeah, that's a problem. I mean, that's everything I learned while hacking on Pulse Audio. There is no documentation about this. There's a lot of the real-time people have a wiki. If we read through that, then there's a lot of stupid stuff written there. It's really, really bad sometimes. And there is no documentation. You just have to learn. I'll use my slides or just ask me. So yeah, it would be good if there would be a book about how to actually use that. Yeah. Yeah, of course I am. I could do that, but yeah, I mean.
There's also a book by Christopher Allen that's on embedded Linux programming that came out last year, I think.
But does it really go into detail? I mean,
he has some pretty good material on real-time programming.
I mean, the thing is always that you always need to know about these issues, that high-resolution timers are only available in system call and not in that one, and all this kind of mess. I mean, and that's constantly changing. I'm not sure. I don't know of any book, and it would probably be very, very difficult to write a book that's not being outdated in just a couple of weeks. So, yeah. That's it. No further questions.